Welcome to Let's Do It Radio on the homepage of doitallinthemall.com. Welcome to everyone, especially to all of our first-time listeners worldwide. Today is Tuesday, broadcasting out of Yakima, Washington, and guest speaker Janet Schwartz from Columbus, Indiana, keeping history alive. How's everybody doing today? Welcome to Let's Do It Radio on the homepage of doitallinthemall.com. Welcome to everyone, especially to all of our first-time listeners worldwide. Today is Tuesday. If you have a product or business, you can bring it into doitallinthemall.com, where all entrepreneurs can be found under the client's carousel on the homepage of Do It All in the Mall. Do It All in the Mall has been in business for over 13 years and is a secure 24/7 online shopping mall of over 5,000 stores for all your needs. You can shop for anything you need, all while listening to entertainment, all in your own comfort. You can make a difference worldwide. Take a tour and shop. We'll then be ready for discussion. In the meantime, call us at 845-241-9985. And now, we'll hear from our speaker today.
Good evening. This is Janet Schwartz. Tonight, we have our topics, the four topics tonight. We got some good ones. The first one is Damon Keith. Second one is Charles Hamilton Houston. The third is Thurgood Marshall. And the fourth is Sergeant Isaac Woodard. Call us, please, at 845-241-9985. That's 845-241-9985. And we'll be right back after a word from our sponsors, and then we'll be ready for discussion. So let's listen to a word from our sponsors.
When you come in for a coffee, you don't just leave with better mornings.
You leave supporting brighter futures and bigger dreams.
Supporting family business.
Girls with curls.
And working moms.
When you shop Black-owned,
Mexican-American-owned,
Korean and queer-owned,
you leave with change in your hands.
Products you hear at Let's Do It Radio can be found on the website at doitallinthemall.com on our homepage. And be sure to use the menu bar and click on stores and visit over 5,000 stores to shop in the comfort of your own home. So let's go shopping.
Okay, call us, 845-241-9985. The first person we're going to talk about tonight is Judge Damon J. Keith. He was a Detroit federal judge, a civil rights icon. He just recently passed away in 2019. So we've got two clips tonight with Judge Damon Keith. One of them is called Remembering Damon J. Keith, and the other one is called Judge Damon J. Keith Dies at Age 96. So let's go ahead and listen to our clip.
The story goes that while trying to make ends meet while studying for the bar exam, a young Damon Keith was cleaning the bathrooms at a Detroit newspaper. A white guy walked in, saw him holding a law book, and said, "A black lawyer? You better keep mopping." Rather fitting, because by the time he had ascended to the bench as a federal judge in the civil rights era, there was plenty of cleaning up to do. And he did it in decision after landmark decision. His was an all-American life. The grandson of slaves who went on to become one of the nation's longest-serving federal judges, tirelessly committed to the idea of equal justice under the law. That sounds obvious, and yet doing the right thing meant death threats and U.S. Marshals protection for him and his family. But he and his truth won out. "Democracies die behind closed doors," he said. Tonight, we celebrate a life committed to kicking those doors open. An all-American story. An all-Detroit story. The story of Judge Damon Keith.
And we are so glad to have you with us for this special broadcast honoring the life and legacy of Judge Damon J. Keith.
He is one of the most influential figures of our time, and he's had a lasting impact on Detroit and the rest of the country.
Yeah, Judge Keith's work is so profound, nationally recognized as a crusader for justice, and as NBC's Willie Geist puts it, he was a champion of civil rights.
This week, we highlight another life well lived. Damon Keith was born in Detroit on the 4th of July, 1922. His grandparents were slaves. His father worked for $5 a day at a Ford Motor plant, and he grew up to be one of the most prominent federal judges in America. In 1967, Judge Keith was named by President Lyndon Johnson to the U.S. District Court for Eastern Michigan. He gained a national reputation as a defender of civil rights and liberties. In 1970, Judge Keith ordered the busing of students in Pontiac, Michigan, to integrate public schools there. It was the first order of its kind in the North, and it came with heavy resistance and death threats. A year later, he ruled against the Nixon administration and put a stop of its use of warrantless wiretaps. In a famous 2002 ruling against the Bush administration that said deportation hearings could not be conducted in private, Judge Keith wrote, "Democracy dies behind closed doors." After graduating from college, Keith served in a segregated unit of the Army during World War II. He later earned a law degree at Howard University, then worked as a janitor while he studied for the bar exam. Future Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall was one of his mentors. This week, former Attorney General Eric Holder said of Judge Keith, "My career and that of former President Barack Obama would not have been possible without his tireless efforts to break down society's racial barriers." Judge Damon Keith, American trailblazer and fighter for fairness, died last Sunday in Detroit. He was 96 years old.
Life well lived indeed. Our Carmen Harlan had a longtime friendship with Damon Keith and recently reflected on why he connected with so many people.
Judge Keith walked with kings, he walked with presidents, he walked with the common man, and he made everybody feel the same. And that was because of who he was, his background growing up, and he understood that everybody's important.
A great thing to be able to say about a judge.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that
fantastic?
Really should be part of the job, isn't it? Just days ago, the United States Senate passed a resolution honoring the life and work of Judge Keith, a high honor for a more than deserving man, of course.
Fitting indeed. Someone who knows that better than most is Elliot Hall. His friendship with Judge Keith goes back some 60 years, and he talked with me about the basis of the judge's good work and courage.
We were a working-class neighborhood. I mean, Damon's father worked at Ford. My dad worked at Ford.
Back in the late 40s, early 50s, thanks to the auto industry, all you needed was a high school education to get a decent job in Detroit. But a young Damon Keith wanted more than that. His longtime friend, Elliot Hall, told me how the pastor at their church back then, Tabernacle Baptist, preached to the young people to do better.
And he was shaping our lives through making us understand that we could do a lot better in terms of our approach to our future.
Keith would go on to college in West Virginia and then on to Howard University Law School, where he was surrounded by the likes of Charles Hamilton Houston and Thurgood Marshall, men who were the architects of Brown versus Board of Education and other cases that ended segregation.
It was pounded in him that you have to make a difference. When you graduate from the Howard Law School, wherever you go in the country, your task is to free or contribute to the freedom of black folks, voting, voting rights, civil rights, and all the other issues that had the impact. Because it was a very segregated country at the time. Damon graduated from the Howard Law School and came back to practice law in the city of Detroit.
A city where at first he couldn't even rent an office downtown because of the color of his skin.
All the black lawyers were practicing. 90% of them were in the Tobin Building, the only building on the edge of downtown Detroit that would permit black lawyers to rent and have an office.
But those challenges would only drive Keith to work harder to make a difference. He became very active in the community, doing work with the NAACP and Urban League. It was that work that raised his popularity. He became known as not just a good lawyer, but a man of the people. eventually being appointed judge to federal district court.
Then he gets on the court and does things on the bench that were inconceivable. I practiced before many judges in my 54 years as a lawyer. Judges need to have good temperament, respect for the litigants that appear before them, and a good understanding of the law. Damon had a unique ability, and whether you won or lost before him, if he granted whatever you wanted to do or denied it, you felt that you had a fair chance.
And isn't that a great compliment?
Isn't it though?
Yeah.
And it really is not that long ago to think that there was a time when all the black attorneys had to be in one
building
in a city like Detroit.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Now, a man with Judge Keith's resume does leave, of course, quite a legacy, one that you would read about in an American history book.
And some of that history lives on the walls of Keith's private chambers. Our Paula Tutman takes us for a tour.
You know, just walking through his office is incredible, and seeing the pictures with all of the great figures in history. You know what? At 96 years old, Judge Keith was not retired. He was still on the bench. He was still hearing cases. He was actually at work just last Thursday. The people who know him best and love him say, sure, he moved a little slower, but he was still vital and vibrant, so much so that many of them thought that this was a man who may have actually found a way to cheat death.
Pretty holy space right now, right here with Kennedy, you know, Martin Luther King. Here's one with Rosa Parks and the Mandelas.
But for him, there may have never been a him. But for him, there would have never been a her. His rulings affected every fiber of the threads that make this nation a tapestry of what it is.
And then you have a wall like this.
Chief Judge Denise Page Hood took us on a tour of a life well lived in service of others, captured a frame at a time.
But for Judge Keith being in all the positions he was in, most of us would not have been there. I certainly wouldn't have been a judge.
Judge Damon J. Keith was still hearing cases. And so even at his age, there is still a sense of shock and sadness that his final case was his judgment day Sunday morning. A restful slumber that slipped into the meeting with his Lord and the love of his life for 50 years, waiting patiently to be reunited.
Every time he would go anywhere, he would talk about her mm-hmm. and how important she was to him and how much he loved her and his daughters.
He leaves behind family, friends, and a grateful nation. The history of so much of what he's done left behind on the walls of his chambers, where he spent the better part of a 52-year career as one of the longest sitting federal judges, participating in the very underpinnings of our democracy.
A picture with Thurgood Marshall right in the front. And that was a way to educate people, not only students, but also adults, about what the 14th Amendment meant to them.
The 14th Amendment, by the way, provides for and ensures due process. His rulings touched every facet of all of our lives, labor, housing, education, privacy, and yes, civil rights and equality.
He had the ability at the time that he was coming along to really bring together people who were in different communities.
Yeah, and a public visitation for the late judge was held yesterday at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History.
And now the funeral is going to be held tomorrow, 10 a.m. at the Hartford Memorial Baptist Church in Detroit, and then Judge Keith will be buried at Roseland Park Cemetery in Berkeley. Our Rhonda Walker will anchor the coverage live. You'll have that on ClickOnDetroit.com.
Yeah, you know, I never got a chance to meet Judge Keith. I, of course, knew who he was even before I moved here to Detroit, but just phenomenal. And I think I'll never get tired of hearing the stories about everything he did, what he stood for. And it's just amazing. It's such a loss.
What I'm going to remember about him was watching him move in rooms with a who's who of Detroit. Carmen said earlier that Judge Keith's gift was treating everybody the same. Mm-hmm. I will say that other people did not treat him as if he was the same. Mm-hmm. When he was in a room of who's who, everybody was clear that there was one who that was a little bit bigger than everybody else. There was a deference to Judge Keith that you would always feel.
Yeah, he will definitely be missed. Well, as we get ready to sign off, we know putting into words what this titan meant to our country can be a difficult assignment.
But here are some people who tried.
Man will never discover new oceans,
unless I has the courage to lose sight of the shore. I try to teach my law clerks by example that we cannot fight all the battles, all the injustices that come through our court. So let's sort of select the ones that we will go to the wire on, the ones that will have the most effect in terms of Americans all over the country. The cases that I guess I'm identified with, like the Keith case where I told President Nixon and John Mitchell that they could not wiretap without prior judicial approval. They call it the Keith case now. It went to the Court of Appeals, and I was affirmed there. And then the Supreme Court unanimously affirmed. And as a result of that case, Nixon had to turn over all of the Watergate tapes.
He came from this city and became one of the most successful judges ever in the country. He cut down race discrimination in Pontiac and Hamtramck and Detroit Edison.
When I was practicing law, there were no black judges over in Recorder's Court on Wayne County Circuit Court. And they used to treat black lawyers like dogs.
He was consistently told he wasn't good enough, he couldn't achieve, and then he did. And once he did, he didn't forget those who supported him.
I had to struggle all of my life. My father worked in the factory, in the Ford factory, with no benefits, no insurance, no sick days. If you didn't punch in, you didn't get paid. And I could see him going to catching the Grand Belt streetcar, going out to the Ford factory in ice and snow to make a livelihood for my family. And I feel as though I could not let him down and my mother and my family or my race or my country for not doing what I can to make life better for everyone.
He had the ability at the time that he was coming along to really bring together people who were in different communities.
Every morning before I start work in this office, I close that door and I have the Bible there. I read from it. I read from the Proverbs and the Daily Word. I try to give thanks to God for all of his blessings.
I have a strong feeling that man will never discover new oceans unless he has the courage to lose sight of the shore.
The Honorable Damon Jerome Keith often quoted that phrase to inspire others, but he also lived by those words in his dedication to the struggle for equality and justice.
You can make something out of yourself if you work hard and study, keep a clean nose, and do what is right.
Born in Detroit on the 4th of July in 1922, this grandson of slaves would devote his life to upholding the ideals of freedom and independence. The graduate of Northwestern High School was drafted into a segregated army during World War II. Damon J. Keith would then come home to launch his own battle against racial discrimination. In the 1950s, he armed himself with education by going to law school at Howard and Wayne State Universities. In the 1960s, he stood alongside legends in the fight for civil rights. 50 years after the Great March to Freedom on Woodward Avenue in 1963, Judge Keith reflected on being part of that historic day in his hometown.
I don't know what triggered that type of enthusiasm. I wish I could tell you that. It was just something that exploded, and we were all up and down Woodward marching. I was a young man at that time, and I was just thrilled to be a part of it, because we were fighting for freedom.
In 1967, President Lyndon Johnson appointed Damon Keith to Federal District Court in Detroit. A decade later, Jimmy Carter tapped him to serve on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit.
I've had a good career. God has been good to me. And I've had a lot of tough cases, as you know, a lot of controversial cases.
Like the one that blew the Watergate scandal wide open with the decision on wiretapping. Another ruling that ordered busing to integrate Pontiac schools triggered threats.
The FBI had an insider in the Ku Klux Klan, and they threatened to execute me. And
My wife and children didn't know that we had protection around our house.
Judge Keith's rulings also had an impact on job discrimination, minority housing, and affirmative action in the Detroit Police Department.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
He was a master of swearing-in ceremonies and loved showing off the enviable wall of fame in his federal chambers, filled with a who's who of photos.
Coleman Young, Rosa Parks, Aretha Franklin.
Just a few of the big names he honored over the decades at his annual Soul Food Luncheon, a Black History Month tradition, topped off with the Soul and Spirit Humanitarian Award.
Right.
In 2011, he was right there, front and center at his alma mater, to celebrate the opening of Wayne State University's Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights, a legacy that will help generations of law students carry on his crusade.
We've come a long ways. I was in Washington, D.C. for the inauguration of President Barack, and I had tears in my eyes.
But for all the progress he fought for and witnessed during his lifetime, Judge Keith would turn to that often quoted phrase again to remind us there are new oceans yet to discover.
Let us all remember that we have that obligation to lose sight of the shore. We still have a lot to do.
All right, we're back. Judge Damon J. Keith, a Detroit federal judge who passed away in 2019. He was grandson of slaves, born in 1922. And I find it interesting, well, I don't find it interesting. It just seems like it's back in those days that he had to have U.S. Marshal protection for him and his family. And I think I found that of these judges that we're going to talk about tonight, that most of them needed some kind of federal protection or else they would have been killed. So he had his saying, democracies die behind closed doors. I think that was a saying that drove him to do what was called the Keith case. They call it the Keith case of you cannot have wiretapping without a search warrant. So we had President Nixon who had made the secret Watergate tapes. And as a result of the Keith case, Nixon had to turn over those Watergate tapes. Of course, now we know that I think it was 2.5 hours are missing. I'm not sure that they ever found those tapes. But that was part of what a great landmark case that he had. So, lots to talk about here, lots to be impressed with, lots to remember. Excuse me. Andre, you are on the line with us. Do you have any thoughts or insights about Damon Keith? Damon Keith?
It's just that people themselves, if you notice in history, they have to go through a lot of things to get to where they want to be and make certain points in history. And it's sad because according to the Constitution that you hear, when it says all men are created equal, those things were never applied to periods in time where people had to go through a situation of trying to get protection, trying to get help, trying to fight through things. So as we know, we can look at the history and say that that was not the case. All men were never created equal and will not be created equal.
Right.
So it made the struggle a little harder to just make a point at that time, which is all you know, praises to him because he took on the challenge. But it's hard to understand that as of today, because a lot of people today don't know the struggles they went through to get us where we are today.
Right. I'm glad you brought up those points. Again, that also relates to the U.S. Marshal protection for him and his family. That this one of the struggles, as you mentioned, that they faced during those times in the 60s, 50s, 60s. And I like his saying, man will never meet new oceans unless he is willing to lose sight of the shore. So what a great mantra to live by. And apparently he tried to get the people that worked for him to see that for themselves. It's interesting when they opened up the Damon J. Keith aspect or part of the at Wayne State University, they had in bold letters up above that says his saying, democracies die behind closed doors. As a result also of the Keith case, Jimmy Carter signed what was called the FISA Act, F-I-S-A. And the FISA Act establishes procedures for physical and electronic surveillance and collection of info of foreign powers suspected of espionage or terrorism. So we had that signed into law by Jimmy Carter, or just signed as an act. And we're going to find this out with all the judges tonight, that they all met a strong adversity from the outside world, and that many of them needed protection from people that wanted to kill them. And what a great example with Judge Damon J. Keith, and a long life, that he was on the bench until he was 96 years old, that he didn't even, you know, retire per se. He was working up until the last few days of his life. Now, there is a movie that was made about him, and I looked up and down to try to find if it was on any of the streaming networks or if it was on Amazon Prime. I could not find this movie. You can find trailers for it on YouTube. The movie's called Walk With Me, The Trials of Damon J. Keith. It was made in 2016, and it was a documentary. Again, that's called Walk With Me. All right, you can probably go to YouTube, insert Damon J. Keith and the words Walk With Me, and you'll find the trailers there for the documentary. So I'm going to keep an eye out. If I ever find that documentary, I'll definitely mention it on the show at a later time. There's also a book on Amazon called Crusader for Justice, Federal Judge Damon J. Keith. And at doitallinthemall.com, you can go there and click on Amazon and look for this book. If you can't remember the name of the book, you can just insert the name Damon J. Keith and it will come up. Again, it's called Crusader for Justice, Federal Judge Damon J. Keith. I'm not sure who wrote it. It was not a biography or an autobiography, so I forgot to look up who the actual author was. But that you can find, again, on Amazon if you go to doitallinthemall.com and click on Amazon. All right, so we're going to look at one of his mentors, which was Charles Hamilton Houston. But before we do that, call us 845-241-9985, and we're going to be right back with a word from our...
I started Crowd Cow because a friend of mine brought me some meat that he got from a little farm, and it tasted so much better than anything I'd ever had. So I thought, why can't we take all the little farms and put them online and make them accessible to everyone? Today, Crowd Cow works with the top 1% of all craft meat farms, so you can know your farmer and eat better meat.
When you're blowing your nose really hard, does your tissue fall apart?
Just go right through them.
I blow right through them.
It doesn't hold. It tears.
Give me
one tissue, I'll destroy it.
That's why there's Puff's extra strength.
The softness and the strength.
It's made to take the biggest sneezes, the hardest blows, because it's twice as strong when wet than the leading regular tissue.
I want the ones that don't fall apart. After all those blows, they're tough.
Funny nose, and stays dry.
Puff's extra strength.
Strongest for your nose through all the blows.
Best of both worlds, soft and strong.
Thank you.
That was Going in Circles by Kirk Whalum. Going in Circles by Kirk Whalum. Thank you for that song. We have our next clips here about Charles Hamilton Houston, one of the mentors of Judge Damon Keith, who we just talked about. The first one is just simply titled Charles Hamilton Houston, and then the second clip is called Charles Hamilton Houston, The Man Who Killed Jim Crow. So let's go ahead and listen to our clip.
Dr. Charles Hamilton Houston was born on September 3, 1895, in Washington, D.C. He attended Amherst College, where he was one of six valedictorians. After graduating, he taught English at Howard University before joining the U.S. Army during World War I and then attending Harvard Law School. While serving in a segregated military unit, Houston saw that African-American service members were treated poorly and could be convicted of crimes without any substantial evidence against them. Witnessing this unequal and unfair treatment made him decide to become a lawyer. Houston started law school in the fall of 1919, and in 1922, he became the first black editor of the Harvard Law Review. Dr. Houston was also a member of the prestigious Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity, Incorporated. As a lawyer, he went on to play a role in a majority of the civil rights cases that went before the Supreme Court. These took place between 1930 and the Brown v. Board of Education case in 1954. In fact, his work to dismantle the Jim Crow laws earned him the nickname, The Man Who Killed Jim Crow. Due to the American Bar Association's refusal of access to African-American members, Dr. Houston helped found the National Bar Association in 1925, which is an organization for African-American attorneys and judges. Dr. Houston was also awarded the NAACP's highest honor for achievement, the Spingarn Medal, and has a hall named after him at Harvard University Law School. For the Eastern Progress, I'm Jordan Taylor.
But there was much left to be done if Black America was to enjoy the benefits guaranteed to all Americans by the Constitution. One man, Charles Hamilton Houston, believed that not only could the NAACP do more, it had to take the lead. In 1935, he left his job as the dean of the prestigious law school at Howard University to become the NAACP's first full-time salaried legal counsel in 20 years.
Charles Hamilton Houston went to South Carolina with a movie camera and would film county by county the black school and the white school. And it was just this visual essay in inequality, but inequality doesn't even describe it. I mean, just the awful conditions that young black children went to school under. I mean, they had schoolhouses where there were cracks in the wall. They were crowded together on benches. And then the white school in the same county would be a brick structure, two stories, basketball court. I mean, it was just so clearly unequal. And he would use that to show in the North to kind of get support for the campaign and really put a face on what segregation meant.
There were still people, even the NAACP, who thought that black people simply had to improve their own worlds and to make them sort of somehow better and more sustainable. Houston said, it won't work that way. We have to basically integrate ourselves into all of the public goods and public resources that are around us. And until we do that, we're going to always be considered inferior.
Discrimination in education is symbolic of all the more drastic discriminations which Negroes suffer in American life. And these apparent senseless discriminations in education against Negroes have a very definite objective on the part of the ruling whites: to curb the young blacks and prepare them to accept an inferior position in American life without protest or struggle. The discriminations practiced against the Negro are no accident. Charles Houston.
Houston was convinced that the battle for civil rights had to be won in the schools, but would have to be fought in the courts. Houston knew that the Constitution, properly understood and rightly applied, would give black Americans the freedom they were fighting for. So he took the fight to the courts.
My grandfather saw the courts as the ideal way to achieve equality, because if you fought that fight and you won, well, then it would be a legitimate victory. and it would be one that would be recognized by everyone and would have the weight of authority behind it.
Their hope was to build towards some Supreme Court decisions that would begin to turn the tide and open the way towards challenging segregation in education. And so he had a strategy.
Charles Houston, having his training from Harvard Law School, understood that judges are not going to make decisions that will overturn rulings having to do with constitutional interpretation unless absolutely necessary. So it was Charles Houston who became the strategist and the architect for a campaign that would gradually dismantle the precedent of Plessy versus Ferguson, the 1896 separate but equal doctrine.
So they began to carefully pick cases that they would litigate, pick cases to win.
And cases to establish precedent. Cases that, in Charles Houston's words, would make plain the inequality that existed in the educational opportunities of blacks and whites, and would make true equality too expensive for states to maintain. In 1936, Houston and his legal team would find a case with all the right components. Lloyd Gaines, a college graduate, had been denied entrance to the law school at the University of Missouri because of his race. Houston argued that Missouri was obligated to either build a law school for blacks equal to that of whites or admit him to the University of Missouri.
Gaines became the first time when the United States Supreme Court was asked expressly, does a state have an obligation to provide professional education to people of color if there is no professional education available within that state? And the court said yes, and they ordered the University of Missouri to allow Lloyd Gaines to be admitted, and it was incredibly influential.
The Gaines case laid the groundwork for Houston's master plan. It would become the basis for the legal battles that would one day bring an end to legalized Jim Crow in America. But this one victory would not be enough for Charles Hamilton Houston. Over the years to come, Houston would pursue cases at every level, fighting against segregation in all aspects of American society.
He saw himself as a soldier who needed to work 20 hours a day, and he did so very, very often.
My grandfather had no tolerance for slackers or laziness or excuses. He believed in getting it done no matter the personal cost.
I think my father saw himself as a soldier, as a fighter in a long campaign against injustice. He did not stint in his hours or in his travel or in his legal preparation, despite the fact that his health was declining.
After suffering two heart attacks on April 22, 1950, Charles Hamilton Houston died.
My father, on his deathbed in the hospital, was given a book written by the attorney Louis Neiser entitled Peace of Mind, and that in the margin of one of the pages of that book, he inscribed to me the message, Tell Bo, which was my pet name as a boy, that I did not run out on him, but that in every fight, some fall.
We are back. Charles Hamilton Houston started out seeing unfair treatment of African Americans in World War One. The fact that the African Americans could be accused and tried of things that supposedly they had done based on very little evidence or corroboration. So it was that point that pivoted him to decide to become a lawyer. Now, at Harvard, he was the first black editor of the Harvard Law Review. And that Harvard Law Review had been around for a while. It was started in 1887. So that's pretty prominent there, the first black editor of the Harvard Law Review. He's known as the man who killed Jim Crow by adjudicating several cases, mainly what was called the Gaines case, and that was a young man, African-American, trying to get into the University of Missouri and was denied because of his race. And so Charles Hamilton Houston took it to the state of Missouri and said, listen, if we're separate but equal, you either have to admit him into University of Missouri or build a whole separate building, a whole separate law school for this young man to go to. Well, of course, the choice that was given to them, they said, yes, we're separate but equal, but we're going to go ahead and let him join or be accepted into the University of Missouri. So that was one way, one of the cases where he slowly dismantled what was called the Jim Crow laws and gave him the name the man who killed Jim Crow. He's also the first NAACP full-time salaried legal counsel. And I like the fact that he went down south and filmed the black schools and the white schools to show the contrast between the two. And they talked somewhat about that in the clips, about the glaring differences. And by attacking segregation, again, that was attacking the Jim Crow laws. So, Andre, what are your thoughts on this so far?
It's just, it's history. It's history that you would not find taught in high schools or college, because
mm-hmm.
it makes people think a different way. And that's the thing that some people don't want you to do. They want you to think a certain way or find that information because it could stem and steer someone to a different career path.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear these kind of things of what was going on at that time and the effort that was put into it, it kind of gives you encouragement to follow that path or stick to it if you're already in a situation like that. So, like I said, it's just history that it should be taught in schools but will not ever be taught in high school or college.
Right. Right. And it definitely needs to be taught. There's just so much black history that one month given, it's called the Black History Month, can't possibly cover. And we do need a curriculum that will address black history and inspire our African Americans or anybody in the world or in the listening to about these people to inspire them to greater things. Now, he also had to found the National Bar Association because blacks were not admitted to the American Bar Association, and that was back in 1925. So again, you know, here he is, a full-time salaried legal counsel and founding the National Bar Association, saying, okay, you're not going to let us in here. Well, let's go ahead and form our own group so that we can all have a camaraderie and discuss law together and what should be the, what do you want to call it, the standards for admittance to the Bar Association. So that's Charles Hamilton Houston. We're going to see that he was the mentor of many of these men who became prominent judges. And the next one that we're going to talk about who was mentored by him is one that we all know, Mr. Thurgood Marshall. But before we get to that, please call us at 845-241-9985. That's 845-241-9985. We're going to be right back with a word from our sponsors.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Before we continue, I need all of you that are listening right now to do me a very quick favor. At the homepage of blogtalkradio.com/ do it all in the mall, I need you to click the follow button. By following this, you could win a $25 gift card. The only way to do that is to click the follow button. But the only place you can do that is by clicking the follow button at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/do it all in the mall.
Okay, so like, my neighbor is always trying to outdo me. I get a TV, she gets a bigger one. I go to the zoo, she goes to Africa. Little does she know, I started shopping at Walmart. I get electronics, food, clothes, and even my fave cosmetics. Who's a smart shopper now?
Where are you going today, Brittany?
Dad, start the car.
Woohoo! Savings and rollbacks happen every day on all your favorite products. Walmart. Long live the smart shopper.
We'll be right back.
Okay, that was another song by Kirk Whalum called Do You Feel Me? Now, we're back. Please call us at 845-241-9985. That's 845-241-9985. We are going to talk about Thurgood Marshall, and we have two clips. One of them is called Moments in History, Remembering Thurgood Marshall. The other one is called Thurgood Marshall's Remarks on Racism Still Relevant Today. Let's go ahead and listen to the clips.
The following program was produced by the United States Courts.
Thurgood Marshall, the Civil Rights Crusader, a man who was instrumental in ending legal segregation and later became the first African-American justice of the Supreme Court. In this special series we call Moments in History, we remember a man who challenged our legal system to create a more perfect union and forever change our country. Thurgood Marshall was born in 1908 in Baltimore, Maryland. His mother, an educator, and father, a railroad porter, steered Marshall into a law career. After graduating with honors from Lincoln University, Marshall applied to the University of Maryland Law School, but was denied because he was African American. So he traveled for an hour daily to Howard University Law School under the tutelage of a prominent NAACP attorney, Charles Hamilton Houston.
One of the suggestions made to Thurgood Marshall by Charles Hamilton Houston was to go to the deepest South, into those pockets of the country where resistance against equality and desegregation were the toughest, and pay attention to the people, listen to them, hear their stories, and understand that you're working for a cause that's bigger than being a lawyer, bigger than being a law graduate, bigger than even anything you can imagine in your life. And Thurgood Marshall took on that mantle.
In 1934, Marshall graduated magna cum laude from Howard. The following year, he started a private practice and eventually succeeds his mentor, Charles Houston, to become the NAACP's chief counsel. During this time, Marshall systematically dismantled the 1896 Plessy v. Ferguson ruling that upheld racial segregation under the separate but equal doctrine. He argued 32 civil rights cases before the Supreme Court, winning 29.
He wanted to establish the building blocks of earlier cases. He didn't want this issue to come up early in the litigation. And I learned a lot about how a person can try to influence the development of an issue over a long period of time.
In fact, it was 13 years before Marshall had a chance to challenge separate but equal with the Brown versus Board of Education case in 1954. The ruling ended segregation in the U.S. By now, Thurgood Marshall is a household name, but not everyone is in favor of the landmark decision.
It took an enormous amount of guts. He told us the story about how he'd have to move sometimes two or three times a night from home to home in order to stay safe. He told us the story about how he was very close to being lynched one time. It wasn't just his client, it was he who was in danger.
Justice Marshall was a great admirer of the man I wound up working for, Judge Harold Tyler. And Tyler had been an assistant attorney general in charge of civil rights. One day in the fall of 1960, Marshall was down in New Orleans and was advised that the Klan was coming to get him that very night. He called Tyler, he had Tyler's home number. Within an hour, the FBI picked up Marshall and put him in a secure location and saw him through that. And Marshall credited Tyler with saving his life.
The death threats didn't stop Marshall. After the Brown versus the Board of Education ruling, Thurgood continued to defend civil rights demonstrators until he was appointed in 1961 to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. Of all his rulings, none were overturned by the Supreme Court, and by 1967, Thurgood Marshall became the first African-American Supreme Court justice.
It was fascinating to see the multiple aspects of his personality, the personable, sociable storyteller, the precise taskmaster, just an amazing and remarkable, unique human being.
What was delicious about, most delicious about the clerkship were these stories.
and they ranged from hanging out with Langston Hughes and Lena Horne, Joe Louis, meeting with Prince Philip, helping draft the Kenyan Constitution. So every single story was like gold.
One of Marshall's favorite stories, and Marshall told stories all the time. Many of them were about race relations, many of them were serious subjects, but he always would tell a story with his booming laugh, and they always had a funny ending, even when he was making a very serious point. All the new judges were supposed to come up for a photo shoot, and the photographer blew a fuse while setting up his equipment. So they called for an electrician. Who should walk into the room next? Thurgood Marshall. The secretary looked up at him and said, "Oh, you must be the electrician." He laughed about the story. And why did he laugh? Because at the time, the trade unions in New York were all segregated. And he said, "That woman must be crazy to think that I could be a member of the electricians union in New York City."
By the time I was clerking, I was very interested in hiring clerks who wanted to teach. And we were involved in the hiring process. And we asked him, "Why do you want people who want to teach?" And he had a very long view about influence. He was very explicit. He said, "Of course, I want the smartest people." But he also said, "I want people who will pass on the lessons to a next generation."
In 1991, Thurgood Marshall announced he was retiring from the bench.
It came as a complete shock to us. The morning he did it, he called us in and he said, "Well, I've decided to give it up." And I said, "You're kidding." He said, "No, I've already sent the letter to the president." There was this part of me who, until he said that, I was going to try to talk him out of it. "No, you can't do this. You can't do this." He had already done it. And as far as I could tell, nobody in his chambers knew.
And when reporters asked him why,
"Well, I'm old. I'm getting old and coming apart."
2 years later, Thurgood Marshall passed away at the age of 84.
For the day of the funeral, we went to the National Cathedral. President Clinton was there, the Vice President, many senators, all these important Washington people. And at the end, word got around that the law clerks were invited to the burial at Arlington. So we went there, and I assumed that a lot of Washington dignitaries would be there, but that was not the case. And it was the law clerks and the family, and Justice's family was small. And Sissy Marshall at one point turned to us and said, "Thurgood regarded you as part of his family. And I guess we knew, and he wanted you to be here for this moment." And that was really wonderful.
What made Thurgood Marshall an exemplary leader, in my view, is that he never stopped having utter empathy for common folk, people who were disadvantaged, and he dedicated his life to using the law to help those folk, regardless of color.
It reinforced my interest in public service. When you have a role model like that, when somebody, a person like that is putting his life on the line in the interest of the ideals, it's very hard to want to do anything other than to find a way to give back. There's almost nothing any of us can do in this generation that rivals the level of commitment and risk that he put on the line, for the causes he believed in.
Today, you can find numerous memorials from coast to coast honoring Justice Thurgood Marshall, from courthouses to national airports, even the building I'm standing in now. For the U.S. courts in the Thurgood Marshall Federal Judiciary Building, I'm Bridget Lyle. Thanks for watching.
Stop talking about how far we've come and start talking about how close we are. I repeatedly tell young people, you're better off than before, and be patient and things will get better. And the thing that gets me now is not only telling me, "That's what you told my father," they say, "That is what you told my grandfather, and things are no better for me." It's admitted in the Times, New York Times reports, or Time Magazine, that a recent survey shows that racism is broader and stronger than before. We're not gaining ground, my friends. We might be losing. But one thing I'm sure of is there's no time to stop.
There's a terrific problem. And we believe that the people I represent have been very considerate about this. They've taken it for 70 or 80 years, and we believe that now is the time to get around to having our Constitution apply to all sections of the country equally and to the same effect in a more or less uniform fashion.
Marshall, the first Negro to serve on the United States Supreme Court, puts on his robes with the assistance of his wife.
President Johnson called the pioneer civil rights lawyer most qualified by training for the post.
Justice Marshall, the great-grandson of a slave, swore to do equal right to the poor and to the rich.
All of us have a job. And one thing, we can't do it as an individual. And we can't do it as small groups. We've got to have the one thing in mind. And I'm going to close with what I've been saying for 50 to 60 years. I don't care about the Constitution alone, or this Declaration of Independence, or all of the books together. It's not that important. What is important is a goal toward which you're moving, a goal that is the basis of true democracy, which is over and above the law. And it's something that won't happen, but you must pray for it and work for it. And that goal is very simple. That goal is that if a child, a Negro child, is born to a black mother in a state like Mississippi or any other state like that, born to the dumbest, poorest sharecropper, is by merely drawing its first breath in a democracy, there and without any more, is born with the exact same rights as a similar child born to a white parent of the wealthiest person in the United States. No, it's not true. Of course it's not true. It never will be true. But I challenge anybody to take a position that that is not the goal that we should be shooting for. And stop talking about how far we've come. And start talking about how close we are. Thanks again.
Okay, Thurgood Marshall, born in 1908, the first African-American on the Supreme Court and student of Charles Hamilton Houston. Now, he was told to go to the Deep South to see what was going on, to see what you're working for. That's what he was told as a student, to see all these differences, to experience, to talk to the people in the Deep South, to get their experiences so that he can have a stronger idea and a more bigger conviction about what he was working for. And also, again, just like the other judges, there was an account about how he had to move 2 to 3 times a night just to stay safe. That at one point the Ku Klux Klan was coming after him to kill him, and yet he was taken under FBI protection for that. So he had the saying, stop talking about how far we've come and start talking about how close we are. Great words of wisdom to live by. Stop talking about how far we've come and start talking about how close we are. He was famous for his case, litigating his case for Brown versus Board of Education, that landmark case that ruled that segregation was unconstitutional. So we got a lot here. There's a lot more about him, but those are the highlights of Thurgood Marshall. And I definitely remember him being on the Supreme Court. Let's go back to Andre. Andre, what are your thoughts on what you heard and some of the things that Thurgood Marshall said?
Well, you know, I've actually researched Thurgood Marshall back in high school and college, and I know a lot of things that he accomplished during his time. What I find a lot hard to swallow sometimes is that Hollywood will wait 50-plus years before bringing something like this to the screen, like they did with Chadwick Boseman just recently a couple of years ago, about this man's accomplishments. And not understanding it, and people say, well, why is that important? They wait 50-some years, they finally get to the screen. Well, here's the thing. For those people that right now on the line that are over 50, they know who Thurgood Marshall is. But for those under 50 and waiting 50-some-odd years to show what he did, what's going on, it doesn't matter to those people that see it now. They hear it. They understand what he's doing and what he's done. But it doesn't matter what influenced anybody going forward. I think if this would have been brought to the light when he actually did things, or shortly after he retired, then again, another direction of people thinking and reacting to their surroundings and what they could do and what they could not do in that society. It's just that they got to get, you know, stop putting these 15, 20, 40, 50-year gaps before putting history out there, because, again, history itself is something that is very different these days. So if you don't tell it, you'll never know.
So you researched him in both high school and college.
Correct.
Sounds like if you researched him in college that it would have been some pretty deep research. Are there other things that you learned about him when you did that in college?
Well, it showed me a lot of the things that he actually worked on and accomplished, because some things he was not successful. So there's some things he lost, some court things he lost. But they talked about all the things he put forth. And that's the thing about it. First of all, at that time period that he was in, they were not known to have a lot of black people in that position.
Right.
So that was the first thing, blacks looking up to him saying, hey, I want to be that. Like Obama in his presidency. That position has never been filled or even seen or thought of having anybody in it other than who you've been having. But the moment he gets in, every black person in the world wants him to walk in there and start and just change the whole world around because he's black. And that's not his position. Job is to go in and do other things that help you down the road. And a lot of people didn't appreciate it, as they didn't appreciate Marshall's moves made back in the time that he did. He did things to better the future of your life, not for that moment for you to walk around and, you know, proud and say, look what we did. He's bettering something that can go down the road, and it has happened because now you have a lot of people in that field who know thoroughly who he is and what he's done, because some of them are looking to him as a martyr or someone to follow because of his action. And if, like I said again, this is history that will not be taught in high school or college because no one wants it to be told.
Right. Well, thanks for sharing that. I appreciate it. I'm really impressed that you've done all the research on him, both in high school and college, and I really appreciate your comments. And again, this is not taught at the high school level, and it needs to be. There's a lot of Black history that needs to be taught so that our young people can be aware and also look for a role model that they can imitate. So interesting things that I found when I was reading about him is that he grew up debating. And the way that he would debate is that his father actually took him to watch court cases. And after they were done watching those court cases, they would go home and debate the issues of what was going on. So he had a father that raised him that way to keep sharp and up on court cases. And also they would debate common events or current events at the time. One thing to show you how he's just a regular person like all of us, not that we would all do this, but when he started out at a place called Lincoln University, he was actually suspended 2 times for hazing and pranks. So he didn't take it very seriously at first, but I guess he showed that he's normal just like the rest. He graduated from high school a year early, so I'm just wondering if the immaturity was the maturity was not quite there yet. And actually, it wasn't, because we see later on from the clip that he graduated from Howard Law the first in his class. So he got his act together, got all these high educational accomplishments and graduating first in his class. And as you can see, what he went on to be. All right, call us, 845-241-9985. That's 845-241-9985. The last person that we're going to talk about tonight is Isaac Woodard, W-O-O-D-A-R-D, Isaac, Sergeant Isaac Woodard. And we're going to listen to 2 clips. The first one is called Sergeant Isaac Woodard, Sergeant Isaac Woodard's Story, The Blinding of Isaac Woodard. And the second one is called How a Black Veteran's Blinding Led to Integration. So let's go ahead and listen to those 2 clips, and then we'll talk about it.
Good morning, this is Orson Welles speaking. I'd like to read to you an affidavit. I, Isaac Woodard Jr., being duly sworn, do depose and state as follows. I'm 27 years old and a veteran of the United States Army, having served for 15 months in the South Pacific and earned 1 battle star. While I was in uniform, I purchased a ticket to Winsboro, South Carolina, and took the bus headed there to pick up my wife to come to New York to see my father and mother. About 1 hour out of Atlanta, the bus drivers got off and went and got the police. The policeman grabbed me by my left arm and twisted it behind my back. I figured he was trying to make me resist. I did not resist against him. Another policeman held his gun on me while the other one was beating me. I started to get up. He started punching me in my eyes. He knocked me unconscious. I woke up next morning and could not see. He took me to the Veterans Hospital in Columbia, South Carolina. He told me I should join a blind school.
You have a man wearing a dress uniform. He has medals on his chest. All the symbols of sacrifice and service are there. And it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter.
To a white Southerner in 1946, nothing is more provocative than a black man in uniform.
You have law enforcement coming with the full savagery of Southern racism. No one can say that what happened to Isaac Woodard was justified.
It just seemed to be something that shouldn't happen in America.
Now, it seems the officers of the law, it was just another white man with a stick who wanted to teach a Negro boy a lesson, to show a Negro boy where he belonged, in the darkness.
Are we going to have people who live in the United States and are less equal than others? What are we going to do about this?
His blindness allowed us to see. It allowed us to open our eyes and see the injustices that were done to African Americans in this country and still going on today in 2021. I am Laura Williams, the author of
I am Sergeant Isaac Woodard Jr., How My Story Changed America. Sergeant Isaac Woodard was my great uncle. His elder sister was my grandmother.
Laura Williams' great uncle Isaac was a civil rights pioneer who never intended to be one.
Isaac Woodard was born on March 8, 1919 in Winnsboro, South Carolina. At age 23, he enlisted in the United States Army, and he served the country for 3 years, and he actually won several awards. He received a battle star for unloading ships under enemy fire. He earned his star. His unit was strictly African American. It was segregation the entire time. There was no desegregation yet. And on the day of his return back to the States, which was February 12, 1946, he took a Greyhound bus heading back to Georgia, home to his new wife and family. And that trip changed his life forever. The bus made multiple stops along the way. One particular stop, Sergeant Woodard went to the driver to ask if it's okay for him to use the restroom. And of course, he's leaving from the back of the bus, right, because of course it's segregation. The bus driver just dismissed his request and spoke to him in a very disrespectful manner. He basically told Sergeant Woodard, go sit down, go back and sit down. And he had every right, you know. He says, listen, I just fought for this country. Speak to me as a man as I'm speaking to you. I think I deserve respect. And of course, he had his full uniform on, so there was no question of who he was or where he came from or what he represented. The driver at the time told him, sure, go ahead, use the restroom. He didn't say anything further to him until they reached the following bus stop. And when they reached that second bus stop in Batesburg, South Carolina, the driver got off the bus, summoned two police officers who were nearby, and brought them back on the bus and told him that Isaac was drunk and disorderly, which was not the case. Yet, they believed him. They escorted him off the bus, and shortly after that, they began to beat him. And they beat him so severely that they blinded him. The nightsticks at that time, they had sort of like nails protruding from them. They used the end of those nightsticks and to hit him in his eyes. Of course, it lacerated his corneas, and he was permanently blinded. After that happened, he was taken to the county jail. Of course, the bus went on its way. He was just thrown in a cell and left unattended, no medical treatment, bleeding, in pain, in anguish, alone, I'm sure traumatized, and left there overnight.
The next day, Isaac Woodard was brought to a courthouse and charged with disorderly conduct. He was fined all the money he had on him.
And then basically said, you're free to go. Now here he is, he's 27 years old, just returned home, beaten, blinded. He has no idea of where he is, where to go. So he's free to go where? Where is he going to go? There's no place to go. He just asked to be taken back to the jail, to the cell where he had spent overnight, just to at least gather his thoughts, I guess, but he was beginning to feel physically ill. Over time, they realized that he was getting so ill that he had to be taken to the hospital. He was driven to the Veterans Hospital, where he spent the next 2 months. He did get treatment there. They tended to his wounds. He had x-rays. They were able to determine the extent of his injuries. And I believe one of the physicians said it was just so severe, it was hopeless. There was nothing they could do.
Woodard avoided serious injury while serving in World War II, only to be blinded for life back home.
To make matters worse, he was denied his veteran benefits.
After 2 months in the hospital, Isaac's two older sisters brought him to New York City. And then things started to happen.
News spread quickly around the country. And the NAACP came to his aid. They rallied around him, and they knew that he wasn't able to receive veterans benefits. So they decided to hold a benefit concert for him to raise funds to help support him. Nat King Cole, Billie Holiday, Pearl Bailey, Count Basie, who is a very notable jazz pianist, and boxer Joe Louis. They agreed to be a part of this benefit, and they sold tickets, and the tickets sold out in one day. And from then on, he decided that he knew that he needed to spread the word and let people hear his story. So he began to tour the country. He went from place to place and explained to them about the inequities of African Americans and police brutality. And this was back in 1946. He just wanted to let people know that, you know, this isn't right. And, you know, basically, look what happened to me. And even President Truman heard of his story. And from that, he formed a Council on Civil Rights.
As a first step, I appointed an advisory committee on civil rights last December. I am confident that the product of their work will be a sensible and vigorous program for action by all of us.
That was the first ever in this country. That's when it started. President Truman then decided to desegregate the armed forces. So because of Isaac's story, the armed forces were desegregated.
It seems Isaac made an impression on everyone who heard his story.
I remember my dad telling me about how much mail he would receive from people around the world. One letter in particular, my dad mentioned of a young girl in Germany who had heard about Uncle Isaac's story. She wanted to help. And what she did was she sent Isaac a letter telling him that she wanted to help him, and she included her $8 savings.
And of course, Isaac was loved at home as well.
I just have very fond memories of him. Uncle Isaac was a good cook, even after he became blind. He was a wonderful man. He was a very loving relative, and he ended up taking things in stride. He didn't become bitter over the long haul. He dealt with it, and he made the best out of his life. I wanted to write the book to pay homage and honor to my Uncle Isaac and the legacy. So we have to teach the children from what happened then and how we can change things now and live in a better world.
This is Inside Edition Digital.
So here we have a devastating situation with Sergeant Isaac Woodard. Now, before we go on, we do have a caller on the line, and the last four digits of the phone number is 0380. Do we have a caller with 0380 on the line?
Good evening. Good evening, everyone. Good evening, Janet. This is Reverend Ron Marshall from Little Rock, Arkansas.
Oh, yeah. Good evening. How are you?
How are you? Oh, what some people would say, never better.
Okay. All right. Thanks for calling in. Do you have any thoughts so far that you want to share, or are you just listening?
Well, Jenny, just one point. Officer Woodard was mistreated terribly. But all races are relatives. And I think when that concept gets into people's head, then I think it's going to be a change of heart. And it's happening slowly, but I think when it fully sets into people's mind, all races are relatives. I can give you facts.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, spiritually, I think it's around about the 11th, 12th, maybe 10th, 11th, 12th of Genesis, after the flood, Lucifer's flood, then everything was abolished and demolished from the earth. And after that, you know the story of Noah and his ark and his eight, you know, people and his family and all of the livestock. Well, when they parked, when Norton found dry land and the tsunami of water had subsided, the Bible clearly states that through these eight people, the earth was populated again all over.
Right. Right.
So if we look at it, then there's really no room for hatred because of the pigmentation of the skin. But we all are relatives and we all have the same blood. Everybody can use everybody's blood. That alone tells you that we have close kinship. Now, so since we understand that all races are relatives, then the spirit of separatism and partial should be put to rest. Now, what happened to the officer should never happen to anyone else again, because all people count in America. The United States cannot function with just white people alone. The United States cannot function with just black people alone. It can't function with just Asian people or Hispanic people alone. It takes every ethnicity that is upon the earth for United States of America to work. All the people in the United States are needed to make this system be viable and progressive.
Right. I really appreciate that point about in Genesis about Noah's family. I've never thought about it that way. And yeah, I mean, we are all relatives, all related. Thank you for that point and from everything that you've said, how impacting that is. We're all relatives. Thank you so much for that point. And, you know, I was shocked. I have to say, I'd never heard of Sergeant Isaac Woodard until I researched him. And I was just shocked. I thought, my gosh, you know, I guess this is how it was in the South. He had asked to use the restroom and, you know, was talked to down on. And then the next thing you know, the bus stops and on comes the policeman and he's accused of being drunk and belligerent. So there's a whole story about this that PBS made on the show called The American Experience. I'm not sure if people can access it or not, but it's a whole story about Sergeant Isaac Woodard and how this changed everything. So here we are, and I'm not sure where the story went from there after the whole flood of support that he got. I should have looked up how the rest of his life went. But one thing I know, that the woman who said that he was her great uncle, she wrote a book called I Am Sergeant Isaac Woodard. And you can find that on Amazon for anybody listening out there. You can go to doitallinthemall.com, look under Amazon, and it's called I Am Sergeant Isaac Woodard. And it's actually a children's book set to, like we've been talking about tonight, that these are people not taught in the school system, which they should be. And so this book is aimed at young children to get them started on their own black history. So I'm just amazed at how God can take something like that and how he suffered through that, and yet look at the impact that it made. God put something and made a huge impact across the world with that. As we can see, the little girl from Germany heard about it and decided to send her savings in. So that's Sergeant Isaac Woodard. Do you have any more thoughts you want to add, Reverend Ron?
Yes. Some people say history repeats itself. And just recently, well, not yesterday, but a few months ago, we suffered the same kind of trauma worldwide when Floyd was killed up there in Minneapolis.
Yes.
In Minneapolis. Well, for the most part, if people could get past the illusion, okay, if they could get past the illusion that someone is better than the other person, if they could get that out of the scream of their conscience, then I think that white people would be able to see the significance of people that were brought over here on a boat. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the people were brought over here on a boat, but the people were not animals. They were human beings. And they served a grandiose purpose, even under so much scrutiny and so much mistreatment. But still, there is a blockage in some white people's mind, not all white people, but some.
Mm-hmm.
It's a blockage there, and I call it Lucifer's illusion. And he got them still wanting to act out this thing of hatred, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But really, that's really as a thief of time. This illusion is a thief of time because it's robbing people from global love.
Yeah.
See, global love around the world would make a total difference in the world. And I know some people say, well, that's far-fetched. But now, wait a minute. What do we want? Why do we not want to move forward to the nuance of perfection? What make us not want to operate in that domain of perfection, but rather stay in an imperfected manner where people are mistreated?
Mm-hmm.
I use that word mistreated because it's such a simple word, and people understand it on all levels. So if we can get past the illusion, if we can get past the illusion of partiality and separatism, then we can come together. As Jesus stated in Acts 4:32, when he spoke through the apostles and said, the multitudes of them that believed in the resurrection of the Lord Jesus were of one heart and one soul. When we can develop that oneness globally, not looking at what I have, or tangibility, not looking at availability, but as a human being, you know what I mean? Just the human being, if we can get past the illusion of separatism and jealousy and envy and all of this kind of stuff, then we can be one. And we will be a united nation if we, the people in the nation could ever be one together. Look at what we could accomplish. We'll take over again like we was in the 1800s. We would be leading all around the world in everything. But because of this delusional evil of separatism, well, then we still facing things that were supposed to be over a long time ago.
Yeah. Andre, I can tell you probably want to add something to that. You got any thoughts, Andre?
Yes. Here's the problem that people in religion have in this day and time. They want everything to be quickly forgotten, and we don't understand the facts of the Bible. Let's be clear on something. They want you to forget about slavery and just let it go. Well, we want it to be acknowledged and brought out, but that's what they all want. They want is to be brought and acknowledged. But it's, one thing we understand for sure is that they want to get rid of slavery in schools and keep the Holocaust alive. But what we know is in the Bible is very simple. The Holocaust is not in the Bible, but slavery is. If we don't teach our people and get them to acknowledge what's going on, stop the kumbaya situation. This is not going to be an all holding hands, singing song situation. When George Floyd died last year, people were in the streets talking about Black Lives Matter. While they were in the streets talking about Black Lives Matter, the actual website said two things that did not make any sense or coincide with the movement. One, it said their, one of their missions was to get rid of the black man in the family. And their second mission was to support the LGBTQ community. And they did that this year by giving 9% of the money they raised from the Black Lives Matter to the gay community. I don't know how that helped George Floyd. Remember now, when the Asians had a problem with the hate group, they made a law in 90 days and put it in, on the books. Black people have been asking for laws to be changed with George Floyd for years. These things are happening, but not one law been changed. What law in the year 20 to 2021 has been changed because of the George Floyd Act that Colin Kaepernick told you was going to happen in 2016? Nothing. All this forget about things, you can't forget that. That's why God put it in the Bible. He don't want you to forget. He told you in Deuteronomy chapter 28, verses 1 through 15, if you follow his laws, statutes, and rules, commandments, he would give you the world. But because we did not follow him as his people, we went into slavery as in verses 16 through 68. So this kumbaya, when we did the first clear up and acknowledge what has happened, that's why they want to keep talking about the Holocaust, because the Holocaust can blame one man for a situation, and that's Hitler, one man. But if you talk about slavery, you can't blame one man because it wasn't a one-man operation, or was it? There was a nation that identified in the Bible, in history, that says, who did this to these people? They didn't come here on their own. We're the only people, race of people in America that was brought over here against our will, put to work and work for free. No other nation has done that. No other nation has done that way.
Let me interject them.
KKK only attacked the black people. They never attacked no other race. You don't see history showing that either. You don't see no industry where the KKK hung other people than black. You only see black. So why are they attacking just the black people? Where were the Asians? Where were the Mexicans? Where were everybody else at that time? Because they were here. They were here. But you don't see no history where they were burned alive, hung by trees, taken advantage of, and used. And the moment somebody say, I want an identification of who I'm following, or I want an acknowledgement of going on, we should just all love Jesus and go with Jesus. That's, that's that rhetoric right there that has kept us in behind and will continue to keep us behind all our lives. One last thing to add.
Right.
The Constitution, that we talk about all men created equal, do you understand that slavery is, and that was not free until 1865? But the Constitution was written in 1776. When it was written in 1776, there were no black people freed, so all men created equal did not apply to them. Not when it says in written form that a black man is three-fifths of a man. A dog has more rights than a man. That's not all men are created equal. Those rights were written by certain people for certain people, and the laws in this America states the same thing. So we need to get out of that kumbaya, hold hands and sing, because the Bible don't tell you that in Revelation. Revelation don't say about to hold your hands, kumbaya. It says your enemy will serve you in heaven. It didn't say about no kumbaya singing songs. This is the rhetoric that we're hearing in these preachers talking today in these churches, running this narrative that the church wants to pass on them to get them to forget about their history, forget about who they are. Because you ask anybody in America other than black people where you're from, they can tell you. They can tell you where they're from. Ask them their nationality. They can tell you. Black is not a nationality. African-American is not a nationality. That's two continents. As the Bible said in Deuteronomy, we are the Jews, the true Jews of the Bible, and it has proof in that in Deuteronomy chapter 28. So given this illusion that we should just let everything go, we'd be all walking together, we will never be equal. The Bible says it. We will never be equal. We will never have equality across the board because we don't write the laws, and the laws are not written for us. So again, history is what it says. If you ain't teaching it, don't know it, you have no idea. And people are not going to read the Bible. It's already been proven. 50% of the people in America believe in God, but only 9% read the Bible. That means 41% of those people have no idea what the Bible says. They're just going by what the pastor tell them. The God said in the Bible says, can you show me a scripture where it says that? Like I said, I read, I research, I go in the Bible, I understand the and I put the precepts together. I just don't go by it by the kumbaya situation. So I would prefer people if they talk in school to tell them the truth and let them make
what
their own decision.
What do you mean when you say that? Hey, brother,
say it again?
You keep talking about, you keep mentioning kumbaya. What are you talking about?
That whole idea of that we all go just hold hands and sing and be all one equal, one person on the same accord, that's not going to happen. The Bible tells you that. Why would you be delusional and think that it's going to be that way when the Bible itself says it's not going to be that way?
It's that way one way or the other.
And then, you know what? No, that's not what the Bible says. What scripture says that?
But
from Genesis to Revelation, it said, if we do not follow what God said as his people, we will be slaves. And we were slaves from the beginning of Genesis to Revelation to every other nation.
But
that's
do you know why
says.
You were a slave? Do you
it
know why you were a slave?
Chapter 28. Deuteronomy chapter 28.
Do you know why you were a slave?
Why what?
Do you know why you was a slave?
Yeah, because we did not follow God's commandments, statutes, and laws. It says it in the Bible.
Oh, well, so then righteousness is right. And it's not going to change because people tend to follow Lucifer doctrine and the ways of the world that has no merits and anything goes.
And that means there's not going to be no equality across the board. There's not going to be no equality
I want to run something by you. Now, in the same history book, okay?
The Bible?
If you look at it, have you ever heard of the slave trade? Have you ever heard of that?
I have. Yes, I have.
Okay, if you read the slave trade and you read the history that I read, well, then you'll find out the reason why the people that were sent over on the boat were sent over here. It wasn't against their will.
Yes, it was.
They wasn't sent over here.
Yes, it was.
I'm going to tell you. It wasn't against their will. They were held as prisoners of war. Hello?
You think they came volunteering to work for free? That's what you're telling me?
No. Let me
you want me to believe they came up here for free, for fun, to
no.
cruise, and then
what
never
happened,
got home?
What happened was the black people was at tribal wars. And when a king went in, even in the Bible, when the king went in and won the war, he took everything, took the maids, he took the men, servants, he took everybody. He took all of the spoils of that country, gold, whatever they had, he took it.
He took from Judah.
Wait a minute.
Two tribes went down to the south, not everybody.
When he took all of the spoils, the men and the women, he brought them back to his kingdom, so to speak, right? Then a deficit started in there. The king needed resources to take care of all of these people that he had brought over. So a word went out to the Spaniards, and a word went out to the European nations that we got
kings down here.
Have prisoners of war. He's trading them for commodities for his kingdom.
And instead, he made the rule to go take whatever you want to take, make them slaves, and call it a day. And the Africans sold the Israelites as the slaves first. And when they ran out of Israelites, the people that came over there, all the other countries that came over there said, you know what, you all look like we're going to take everybody. But they didn't get on that boat voluntarily to go work
for
them.
No, they didn't take them. They didn't take them. They traded for them.
No, they didn't,
remember,
they didn't trade for themselves.
Prisoners of war.
Yeah,
they didn't
trade
for themselves.
You know, we can get into all kinds of, I appreciate the points that everybody is making, and there's a lot more to this than a lot of people out there realize, and I appreciate both of you gentlemen being on tonight. Please come back the next time we're on the show. And we're going to hear a word from our sponsor right now, and have a song. Thank you so much for being here tonight, Andre and Reverend Ron. I love the debate. Please come back. Please come back.
Hello, everybody.
All right.
Yes, this is Barack Obama, and I'm here to encourage each and every one of you to shop at doitallinthemall.com. This website will make a difference in our communities and in our lives. I encourage you to do all your shopping at doitallinthemall.com. Let's start making a difference today. Support your people by doing something you already do. It's just where you shop, and that is important, and that matters. Keep the wealth in our communities. Shop doitallinthemall.com. And thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you for listening to Let's Do It Radio, our radio sponsor by doitallinthemall.com. Please come back in 2 weeks from now, September 14th, 2021. That's September 14th, 2021, in 2 weeks from now at 3 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Mountain Time, 5 p.m. Central Time, and 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Please stay with us and listen to some song.
Please leave comments on these shows. As you shop through the mall, the more funds we build up and a commission is earned on qualified purchases, go back into your communities where your money matters. You can change lives and make lives matter while making a difference. Nationwide or worldwide, make Do It All in the Mall your shopping headquarters. Donations are welcome as well. Click on the donate button on the homepage of doitallinthemall.com. Contact us if you'd like to be on Let's Do It Radio, have a topic for discussion, or to advertise your business by sending an email to doitallinthemall@yahoo.com or by completing the contact us information on the homepage of doitallinthemall.com. The old-fashioned way works by calling 509-406-6920. You can Skype and tune in, listen or talk with us at 845-241-9985. Tuesdays through Fridays during the following times, 3 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Mountain, 5 p.m. Central, and 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Tuesdays, retired teacher Janet Schwartz, Keeping History Alive, alternating with Ralph Steele, Investment Specialist. Wednesdays, Reverend Carolyn McCullough, Teaching from the Bible. Wednesday evenings, alternating with Stephanie Lott Whitfield, Why Does Love Hurt? 6 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Mountain, 8 p.m. Central, and 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Thursdays, hanging out with Sergeant Parks and keeping it real. Fridays, Perry Whaley, Vitiligo Man of Action, Vibin' with Vitiligo. Fridays, alternating poetry read by Roshamba Adwoa. Saturday, kids' movies, Listen with Your Ears Day, 3 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Mountain, 5 p.m. Central, and 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Sunday service, listen only to guest speakers, 3 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Mountain, 5 p.m. Central, and 6 p.m. Eastern Time. First Sundays, Reverend Carolyn McCullough. Second Sundays, Dr. Ralph Steele. Third Sundays, Reverend Carolyn Williamson. Fourth Sundays, Reverend Ronnie Marshall. Fifth Sundays, Pastor Beatrice Jenkins. We'll close out today's with song.
Thank you.